the Senate Transportation Committee. Let the record show that it's January the 18th at 1 o'clock. And on our agenda today, and I think the agendas are in your packet, we have the Minnesota Department of Transportation, another division overview. And today will be Minnesota MnDOT, Modal Planning and Programming Management Division, with Tim Henkel. And thank you for being here. And I think I'll just go ahead and introduce Mr. Henkel and let him introduce the other testifiers. So welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Good afternoon. My name is Tim Henkel. I'm an assistant commissioner with MnDOT, responsible for directing the Modal Planning and Program Management Division of the department. As you said, as you reviewed the agenda, my role here today is to be sort of the facilitator for MnDOT as we continue our efforts to provide an overview for you of the department. Again, this is not a budget overview. MnDOT is working with its sister agencies as well as the governor in preparing budgets. This is intended to continue our work into more detail on each of the divisions to give you information on role, function, responsibilities, and some of the revenue side of our business. So with that as an introduction, I'll introduce our state aid engineer, Rick Jonas, who is going to take you through the state aid division first, and then I will come back to the Modal Planning and Program Management Division to take care of that for you this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Mr. Henkel. And if I could just note, if there are acronyms in your presentation, we have a lot of new members. We would appreciate very much if you would tell us what the acronym stands for until we get kind of comfortable with that. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, my name is Rick Jonas. Is the mic working? Can you hear?
Seems fine.
Okay. My name is Rick Jonas, State Aid Engineer for Department of Transportation, Deputy State Aid Engineer. And in my general overview of the State Aid Office within the State Aid Division today, there are two county engineers here, too, that are going to talk about their relationship with our office. So as far as today's presentation, I plan to talk about a quick overview of the services our office provides for local government and also the level of funding that we are involved with. In 2007, we became 50 years old. State aid was established by the legislature in 1957. We've been celebrating ever since. It's a very unique and successful creation of the legislature, the State Aid Division. It has served Minnesota well. There are good local highways and streets throughout the state as a result of having a state aid system provided for in Minnesota in such a unique way as it is. Also, very good relationships between local units of government and MnDOT through the state aid system. There are 87 counties within the state. Each of them participate with a portion of their road system being on the state aid system. CASA, you'll hear about the name, the acronym CASA quite often. That's the County State Aid Highway. And MCES, which is the Municipal State Aid Streets. This year, there are three new cities that grew to over 5,000 population. And so for 2011, there'll be 147 cities with participating in the program. And we also have a relationship with townships, too, through the town road and bridge account. The size of the system, more than 30,000 miles on the CASA, County State Aid System, and just under 4,000 miles on the MCES system. The MCES system is growing quite rapidly. New cities are coming on each year, 3-4 cities per year. And also, as cities grow in geographical area, they're allowed to designate 20% of their mileage to the state aid system. So the size of the MCES system is growing quite rapidly in mileage. Our state aid office oversees rules and standards. for the counties and cities in their state aid programs. But it is a system of self-governance. I talked before about this being successful and being unique. The rules are set out by local units of government. They come together and they make the rules, and our office oversees them. The organization of the state aid office, we have a central office. We have district offices throughout the state. Each district office has a person as a primary contact for local units of government to provide assistance for them in their programs or any other thing that they may need access to. We also have program support specialists in a number of areas, from hydraulics to cultural resources to labor and materials, that we make available to help locals with their programs. In our central office, we have a lot of focus on the federal funded projects. We do have an agreement with Federal Highway that will ensure compliance with standards and permits and other regulations in the federal aid programs. On the state aid programs, our involvement per project is much less, although the state aid program is larger. We also manage the state aid dollars and do the distribution of dollars to the individual counties, cities, and townships. In the districts, the district state aid engineers serve as the point of contact for local agencies. In addition, each district state aid engineer serves as an assistant in the district, having a MnDOT function such as planning or construction. They're not strictly a state aid employed. Federal funds, as far as today's overview and looking at that, projects are generally selected by others. And by saying others, what I mean is they are selected by what is called area transportation partnerships or Metropolitan Partnership Associations, MPOs, and those are scattered throughout the state, and every local community belongs to either an ATP or an MPO, and there is competition for federal dollars within those each year, and they normally set out a 3 or 4 year program. The amount of federal dollars, it is competitive, but averages $125, $150 million per year for local agencies, and that contrasts itself with just over $500 million of state aid that we provide for local governments. With your packets today, there's a handout like this that I'd kind of like to go through with you in conjunction with these next few slides. This will be short, and I'm not going to go into tremendous detail about this spreadsheet, but this spreadsheet is well known among local units of government, and it does describe what, until you're acquainted with, is a very complicated methodology of how transportation programs, but especially local programs, are funded. On the other hand, it is actually not all that bad when you take a look at stuff. The green across the top relates to the incomes stream into the highway user tax distribution fund. Motor vehicle gas tax is a big component, as well as the vehicle registration tax and the motor vehicle sales tax, and some miscellaneous interest money that is earned on the accounts. And so when all said and done, the highway user tax fund available for distribution is shown in those green boxes. And it splits out further into a 5% special fund and a 95% general fund. That's in the Constitution. And you'll see that on your spreadsheet. Just below the green, there are two white boxes that show that the fund, the first thing that happens is a 95 and a 5 split. Within the 5% distribution, the legislature does have authority to determine how those dollars would be directed. As you can see, there's about in the handout, using the year 2010 for our example, there are $75 million in that distribution for that year. And if you look along the left-hand margin there, you can see that there are some percentages, 16%, 30.5%, and 53.5%. And those dollar amounts are in relation to the blue boxes along that left margin, where this is the part set by the legislature. 16% of the 5% comprises the town bridge account, and 30.5% is a town road account, and 53.5% is the flexible highway account. And in that flexible highway account, there is $40 million. Many people refer to that flexible account by its former name or former and still primary use, turnback account. This is where the turnback dollars reside. In 2008, when the legislature passed a highway bill, they created a excess account, and the excess account applies here within this flexible highway account. And as it, there was a transition between 2008 and 2010, but as it currently stands, the excess account is money that is available for the metro counties, distributed proportionally among them by population within the metro counties, and they can use that money for safety improvements and routes of regional significance, which is shown near the bottom on the blue row there. So there's that $8 million that Metro can make use of. And just so that I don't mislead you here, the flexible highway count is 50% rural, 50% Metro, and you can see that I guess it doesn't show up in there, but it is. But the excess money is for these unique uses only exists within the metro. The rural counties and cities use it strictly for turnback dollars. They don't have the ability to use the money for routes of regional significance or safety as the metro counties do. The 95% distribution is what most people are more acquainted with, and it is split, again, by the Constitution, 62% for a trunk highway, 29% for counties, and 9% for cities. That's shown in the spreadsheet. The yellow is the cities, 9%, and the orange is the counties, 29%. The cities amount available in on the handout, which is a 2010 year, if you look near the bottom, the MCES monies is $127 million. For 2011, we think we're going to be distributing, and we normally would do this by the end of January, so we're right in the middle of doing the calculations now. We're looking at having about $140 million. So you can see there was some growth in the account from last year, although there was growth in the number of cities and the number of miles also. The CASA account is a little bit more complex in the way we have to do the calculations. In 2008, it kind of froze the current income, and that's why there are two columns of orange. The first column is the way we used to do it, and it's called the apportionment sum. And the dollars are distributed as shown in the bottom of that orange row. 50% needs, 30% lane miles, 10% motor vehicle registration, 10% equal amounts to each county. And looking at $350 million in the ordinary income column for 2011 compared to $325,000 on the spreadsheet. Million on the spreadsheet, excuse me. So there was growth in that area also. Growth in that fund above 2008 levels and some of the new incomes that were made available are called excess sums, and they are calculated out in the far right orange column. And in 2010. Near the bottom of that orange row, you can see the excess amounts are $81 million. For 2011, we predict that there'll be $90 million. The formula for distributing that money between the counties is 60% needs and 40% motor vehicle registration. A lot of information. I went through this very quickly, but I wanted to provide this as an overview for today. So if there are any questions, I'll remain here. Otherwise, what I'd like to do is introduce the next speaker from Candiohi County.
We have a number of questions, so Mr. Jones, if you'd stick around for a little bit, we'd appreciate it.
Yes.
Senator Perry?
Mr. Chairman, did I hear you right that the 5% distribution, how that's distributed amongst the 16%, 30%, and 53% is legislatively distributed? And let me finish this so you can answer them both. If that's the case, of the constitutional, the dollars here, the 62%, for an example, the trunk highway funds, who makes the decision of where they go and how they're used?
Mr. Jones.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the Constitution does set out the 62-29-9 equation between trunk highway, county, and city. It also sets out that there should be a 95 and a 5% split first. It talks about the legislature having authority to, once every 6 years, change the budget for the 5%. And although this has been fairly stable for a number of years now, that the townships have had their two accounts funded at that level, and then the flexible highway account or turnback, primarily turnback account, has been at the level of 53.5%. Within the flexible highway account, if you're asking about how turnback uses are established, we manage Metro separately from outstate because of the way that the detailed budgets are given to us. 50% of the money goes into each area. We take projects primarily on a first-come, first-served basis. We program about a moving target of about 4 years, and it's just based on what is the activity appears to be is why money gets budgeted to the municipal account for turnbacks or the regular account for turnbacks. That's based on the projects we anticipate having. And then we are always adjusting in each biennium between those two accounts to take care of the projects that are local units of governments are negotiating with the MnDOT in the various districts.
Senator Perry?
Mr. Chairman, maybe I'm not making myself clear. The question I have, so we know that we have $891 million in the trunk highway funds. That $891 million is dispersed to the different projects on whose authority?
Mr. Jones?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that would be something that I don't think I can I can really talk about. That would be talked about by others in MnDOT. I work with the 29% and the 9%, the counties and the cities portions, and just try to explain how everything is tied together. Let's see, Mr. Hinkle's going to take a stab at your question.
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Mr. Hinkle.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perry, the 95% is appropriated annually. And then the process unfolds at the agency level within the department. The commissioner, through the prioritization process, distributes those funds. And so the
thank you. That's what I needed. Starts. Thank you.
Senator Reiner, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to follow up on Senator Perry's question and just make sure I have this correct. So the Constitution specifies the 95-5 split. Constitution specifies the 62-29-9 split. Within the 5% distribution, where do we get the 53.5, 30.5, 16% ratio? Is that rulemaking or is that Constitution as well?
Mr. Jones?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the The splits that you refer to within the 5% are established by the legislature, and you're allowed to modify those percentages once every 6 years. It has been more than 6 years since the last adjustment.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up.
Yes, just a moment. Can we get a clarification from Ms. Berzowski?
Thank you.
On that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, the 5% was most recently modified by the legislature in 2008, and I believe the changes went into effect in 2009.
Mr. So we Chairman? Have a number of years under the current formula that you see here for that 5%. But
so, Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, the current percentages were modified in 2008? Okay, thank you. And then a follow-up, if I could.
Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the 5,000-person threshold for the municipal state aid, somebody with some institutional memory, what was magic about 5,000? Why was that set as the threshold?
Mr. Jonas.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, in reading the history of legislative studies and activities in the 1950s, and that equalization component of 10%, I think the best answer I could give you today is that group at that time felt that a city of that size could probably employ a full-time city engineer, and the equalization component was somewhat representative of the amount of money that would take to fund such an office. And that is the documented thought process.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. And Ms. Berzovsky, if you want to do some clarification, I understand you have constitutional knowledge.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out that the 5,000 threshold is in the Constitution.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Chair.
Senator Howell.
Mr. Chair, could you explain just the rationale or the process by which a city designates a municipal state aid route or a state aid street?
Mr. Chairman, Jones. Senator, there is a definition of state aid. I could read it to you, but it's within that community, the relatively more important roads there are. Arterial routes are major collector routes within their community. And what they do every year, they sit down and they on a spreadsheet, they take a look at the number of miles of street and highway within their city limits and break it down by jurisdiction of miles of trunk highway, miles of county, and miles of city. And then they're allowed to take 20% of their city jurisdiction miles and designate them as state aid. And they work with our office to develop that secondary network to the county, complement the county and trunk highway systems within their communities, but limited to 20% of their system size.
Senator Sanchel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Jonas. Can you help me maybe understand a little bit, as for instance, on a mile of county state aid road, and I don't know if this varies county to county, but or project to project, but how much, what percent would be paid by a county level versus, and then what percent by state aid? Or does that vary?
Mr. Jonas.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, when we get to projects and project plannings, I think perhaps the next two speakers will be able to show that a lot better than I. But suffice it for me to say that the amount of construction and major heavy maintenance that counties do on their systems is cost more money than the state aid dollars they receive. When we look at an individual project, it may be 100% state aid funded, and then they may have other locally funded projects that they do, or maybe within their own jurisdiction it makes more sense, or the history of projects are that they may have a cost share on each and every project. That's something within the jurisdictional ability to budget for each county. We would not dictate that. level of percentage. No required match.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sundrum.
I understand I'm not complaining about this. I just wonder about it sometimes. And at least in my own area, maybe with the exception of Highway 52, generally speaking, I think I could say county aid, state aid highways are better than trunk highways. And I've just wondered about that. And is it because then of the contribution of the county towards them? The county plus state aid gets you a better, generally speaking, I think at least, a better highway in my district than what MnDOT builds.
Mr. Jones?
And it's subjective. You don't have to agree with me, but I just think that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I would comment that we are measuring the quality of trunk highways, and we are under the same weight limit law in local units of government are with 10-ton as MnDOT is. Local roads are generally not built for as much truck traffic as other roads. But unique situations that you might be noticing, I can't comment on those.
Senator Hall?
Just, Mr. Chair, just to follow up back on the municipal state aid street, I'm wondering about the rationale for that process, because the municipal state aid streets in each community change based on which street needs to be fixed. And I'm just wondering, what's the rationale for having it designated as that to get funding versus letting the local authority make that decision?
Mr. Jones?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the city, for example, the last few months we've been working with the three new cities to get their core system identified. Since they're brand new. But for the other 144 cities, they have a system. Now, while it's true that they have freedom to change their system, and as their city is growing, they can make modifications, and usually growing cities can add some miles every year because of the growth and annexations of that city's activities and their network. But once set, they're not moving the system designations around to match where they need to spend the money. They're not doing that as a general rule, unless they feel that their system needs to change on a system-wide basis, and they want to justify it that way. If they do take the state aid designation off of a route and put it on a new route because they see the pending improvements and the growth in that area, and that makes sense from the planning perspective in their system, they can do that. But if there was state aid money used in the construction of the route that they removed, they have to pay that money back into their account. They don't forfeit it to the system, but they pay it back into their account. So they're not moving their roads around willy-nilly with their construction projects, and just you don't see that.
Thank you, Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. One point I wanted to raise, and we're going to hear from a county engineer here in just a minute, but it kind of goes to Senator Senjum's point, and that's kind of the local versus the state contribution on local roads. One thing to always kind of hold in your mind as well is, as a state-initiated improvement comes through, or as improvements are being made to these routes of, you know, kind of state significance, whether it's through the county state aid system or the municipal state aid system, but particularly with respect to state highways and trunk highways, often there's a tremendous local contribution as you're improving the approach lanes and the local side of interchanges and intersections and that sort of thing. So there's a dynamic there of local contribution too that we always need to kind of remember occurs. It's a dynamic and an interaction that sometimes we forget about.
Any other questions before we move on? All right. Senator Jones, so I'll let you go ahead and introduce your next testifiers.
Thank you. Gary Danielson from Kandy, Ojai County, the county engineer.
Well, thank you, Senator Gimsey, and the rest of you senators for an opportunity to be here today. I'm the county engineer and public works director in Candy Oye County, and we not only have a road component to what an engineer does out there, as well as ditches, but we also have a sewer system that handles a lot of the lakes in the northern part of the county. So it's probably unique in the sense that the county runs a wastewater treatment plant, and it also runs a water treatment plant, but still our bread and butter is the highway system that was originally set up with the bills back in the 50s and has been changed, but improved a lot since then. The first slide that you see in the handout that goes with that is simply a map of Candy Oye County with Wilmer in the center. And up to the northwest, you'll see that Green Lake is tucked in there, and those are probably the two places in the state of Minnesota that most people would identify as knowing where they were. The blue lines are the county state aid highways, and that's the county state aid highway system in Candy Oye County. We also have a number of county roads, which are much more oriented to lesser traffic and lesser demands, and many of those are gravel. Those are shown in green. And, of course, we didn't show the township roads, but we did show the state trunk highways that are really end up being the backbone of most county systems, and it's a question then of being able to match your county state aid system into that as far as carrying both traffic and heavy commercial traffic, which is a major component of what we do. The there's some I've also put on there, not that most of those roads would have much meaning to you, but we were really asked to talk about a little bit about what we do with the state aid money that comes in and how, once it's distributed by formula back to us, how does the Candy Oye County Board sit down and in a meeting similar to this, but of course a lot smaller with five commissioners, and set priorities and decide what type of work will be done. But those are the roads that are part of our capital improvement program. Now, if you look at the details of the county system on the next page, we have 652 centerline miles, and 437 of that is a county state aid highway route. We have 215 county roads, and if you put those two together, of the 652, 455 are paved, and 197 miles of that is gravel. And if you compare the paved miles to the county state aid highway miles, you'll find they're very close. So most of our county state aid highways are paved because they're the most important roads. They handle the truck traffic and most of the car traffic. And most of the county roads without state aid are gravel. Where you normally will find that county roads end up paved is in conjunction with our lake country, where you get, they aren't necessarily roads that meet the definition of a state aid highway. But they have a lot of traffic on it, and you get to a certain point, especially in lake country or in commuter country with residential developments, that we do have some paved county roads. It amounts to 1,304 lane miles, and I throw that out from the standpoint of you realize we don't have a lot of multi-lane facility out there. A two-lane road, of course, would just be twice the 652. When Mark gets here and talks about Anoka County, you'll see a little different proportion of lane miles to center lane miles. We have 119 bridges, and we've been very proactive over the years in trying to utilize bond money when it becomes available. And this in 2010, we actually had the last four bridges that were rated as deficient in Candy Oye County fixed with the matching of bond funds. Now, that's not 100% that goes into that, but on a county state aid system, the bonds pay for half of the bridge, we pay for the other half of the bridge, and then we end up doing the work then above and coming into the bridge. Most of ours end up being big box culverts. So the typical cost split on that is probably one-third is bonding, and two-thirds then ends up being state aid or other county funds. But we've really appreciated that bonding program over the years, and we've been able to aggressively attack bridges. And in our particular county right now, we don't have any on the deficient list. So we do have some township bridges there. Now, you also see that we have 163 traffic signals. Now, there is some truth in that, but it's only one of the numbers. That's a typo. Okay? If you circle six in the middle, that's the actual number of traffic signals that we have in Kenai County. So we don't. The city of Wilmer has most of the traffic signals, and I'm sorry for that typo, but I caught it. So.
Thanks for clarifying.
Now, there is a variety of traffic counts out there. We have County Road 15, which is in the southwest part of Wilmer. That carries 10,900 vehicles a day as an average traffic. It's near the heart of Wilmer on First Street. Then you get into the rest of the county, they vary a lot. Now, most typical county state aid highways that are paved, there's a lot of variety out there, but there's a lot of them between, let's say, 300 to 1,000 ADT. That would be your typical rural county state aid highway in Kandiyohi County. The ADT is not indicative of how many trucks are out there, but there's really one of the things that has driven our program in selecting projects for a good many years is it actually started 25 years ago, and it was an anticipation in the change of the size of farms and the way commodities were moved. And so we've had we have a lot of heavy commercial traffic, much, much greater than when I started out there a good number of years ago. And the traffic heavy commercial component probably is very often 20-25% of many of these farm-to-market roads. We do have 100 miles approximately of our gravel road system that carry from 35 to 95 cars a day. And as we've done planning as to where, how we're going to go into the future, Kanyuai County is embarking in a jurisdictional turnback program that's expected to last over several years. To turn back perhaps up to 100 miles of those gravel county roads to the township. So that's there are a number of counties that are certainly looking at that. There's two things that have prompted that. One is the need to keep up our most important roads and be able to properly maintain them. As county roads are funded from the property tax, and realizing and looking into the future how tough it would be to raise taxes in that area, we are looking at trying to maintain a good improvement program, but one of the ways we're planning on funding that is getting out of maintaining a lot of our gravel roads. So that has to be worked out by the township. So if anybody would like to go to a lot of evening meetings with township officers, Joe, I'll give you an invite. But
been there.
How do we spend the money that comes into Kanyoi County? In 2010, we received roughly around $5 million in state aid. And what happens with that, according to the law, is 60% of it goes into a construction pot, and 40% goes over to maintain our county state aid highway. Now, part of that construction pot is not just for the rural farm-to-market or commuter routes, but it also, in the cities of less than 5,000 population, they have specific municipal state-aided streets that part of that goes through, too. Of the roughly $3 million that we get for the overall construction program in Kanyoi County each year, there's about $200,000 of that gets designated for these smaller communities. So, for instance, Atwater, Pannock, New London, Lake Lillian, Raymond. That money is set aside for streets that are designated there. As far as the plans on our five-year capital improvement program, the total revenue of coming in of $18.1 million, and that's anticipated with some projected growth that MnDOT has provided us as to what the Highway User Trust Fund might possibly do. Of that, we end up spending that totally on major improvements to the roads. When we do our planning in that five-year plan and the county board sits down and sets its priorities, they include an estimate of the cost to rebuild or do major improvements with roads, and including engineering and right-of-way and those things. And so with the $3 million that we received last year, the planning program for that was to look at what can we do as far as in doing major improvements in roads. Most of the time, a major improvement on the county system involves taking a road that is a fairly narrow road and probably has a 7-ton weight load posting, and not the best surfacing on it, not the best core in it, especially down in our parts of our county, which are very good for agriculture but awful for roads. And we'll take then and rebuild that, put the best dirt that we can find into the core, put a decent amount of granular on it, and then whether it's concrete or whether it's bituminous, I put a surface on there based on the projected truck traffic that will serve without any real maintenance for 20 or 25 years, and that's what a typical improvement will look like. Now, while we're looking at the strength aspect of it, most of our roads out there, too, are commuter routes, so we'll also widen the shoulders, flatten the slopes, and try to improve it from the standpoint of safety and also for our ability to keep the snow off the roads. The municipal amount that we anticipate over the next 5 years is about $1.1 million. If you look down to the bottom, we show a city contribution of about $1.1 million. What happens there is we have cooperative agreements with the city where they'll do some things and we'll do the majority of a road improvement. And we have plans over the next several years with the community of New London, which is up north of Spicer, north of Wilmer, and also on Highway 12 back towards the city, the community of Atwater, to help them rebuild their streets. Normally what happens is they need to put in infrastructure, and then we cooperate and coordinate that with them in order to put a new new drainage, new top, and basically give them a road that should match their 60- or 70-year life of municipal improvements. The county levy over the next 5 years, and of course that's yet to be determined, as I know with the Senate and the governor and everybody else here looking at a $6 billion shortfall. We do know that typically in the past those shortfalls have affected the county. So when I say projected levy into the county bridge fund for improvements, that's dependent on whether or not Kanui County is able to do what they like to do. But that shows a levy of about a little over $2 million a year that is earmarked for the county state aid highways. And what we do is, in order to keep the major improvement program going, in other words, rebuilding roads and replacing bridges, the county, for probably over a 25-year period, has said, we will put enough levy money out there, we'll raise enough taxes off the property tax to do all of the resurfacing without using county state aid highway money. And that commitment over the years, and of course dollar figures change over the years, but in today's dollars, we figure that's about a $2 million a year proposition in order to keep up with the resurfacing program. So we have about $3 million to rebuild roads, which is state aid, and we have about $2 million in this current budget cycle to resurface those county state aid highways. So that shows some of some of the additional funds that come into the county state aid system because there simply is not enough money on its own to both maintain and really see any major improvements that would keep the county up to where it needs to be to look forward, both from a safety standpoint and for economic development. So we do get a little money off the gravel tax, and we're thankful for that. The only bad part is the county pays most of that gravel tax back. So where does some of this stuff go in the five-year plan? We, county, in several times in the past has sold bonds. Right now in a five-year program, we're still paying back a 1996 bond sale, and they're coming down to the last years on that, but our state aid dollars, part of those have to be diverted to pay for improvements of the past. Same thing that the state of Minnesota ends up with when they use bonds. Our preservation dollars, as I mentioned on the other page, where does this money go? Overlays, gravel resurfacing, both on the county roads and the county state aid highway, 100% of that is earmarked to come from the local property tax. Safety projects, we have state aid that specifically goes to that. On the CASA system, we're expecting in a five-year period, depending where you draw the line on safety projects, but those that are really strictly safety, there's about $1.5 million earmarked for that, and about $300,000 on our county roads, and the amount of state aid allocated towards this won't quite cover it, but we do expect to use some levy on that also. Road and bridge replacement outside of engineering, around $17 million. County roads, a lot less. We are planning on improving a number of county roads, but the purpose for the improvement of the county roads, again, goes back to our desire to be able to turn those back to the townships when we're done building them. That saves us the maintenance dollars, which, again, helps us on our major roads over the passage of time. So we are in the midst of that turn back process, working with the townships closely so they don't get harmed in that. And with that, I think I've talked more than I needed to, and I'll be glad.
Well, thank you, Mr. Danielson, and just wanted folks to note that we brought in Mr. Danielson from my home county, and I appreciate you coming.
You bet.
You're on a trip up to another meeting, I understand. Is it county engineers or?
We have our annual meeting this week, so the three of us will be heading that direction as time allows. Yeah.
Very good. We appreciate you coming here, and we wanted to set out a typical example of a rural county, and the next speaker will be talking about a suburban county, so it can give you a little perspective of what's happening out there. So, Senator Perry.
Mr. Chairman, I could tell you were close because you let him call you Joe one time, and you wouldn't let us do that. So. But I do have a question.
Yeah.
Is there a percentage, let me see if I word this right, is there a percentage allowed per county for state aid highways? I mean, for an example, I look at yours and I see a lot of mileage that is state aid highways. Do we cap the percentage of highways in a county at a certain level? Or could a county say all of our highways are state aid highways?
Mr. Jonas? I think this was part of our discussion. I understand Senator Perry's question because when we have a new city that comes up to 5,000, they get 20%. Is there a similar formula or something like that with counties?
The counties are a bit different, Mr. Chair, Senator. The numbers of miles that each county put on their state aid system was established by working committees of legislators and others in the 1950s when the original systems were put together. And there is some variation. Some counties have a relatively higher percentage of their mileage on the state aid system, and some have lesser. It is what it is. And the system that the rules that we have in place are that you take the cards that you're dealt. And if you feel as a growing area that you need to have more miles on a state aid system. You have to meet with committees of county engineers, make a case, and receive permission to increase your state aid mileage within your counties. That is an arduous process that the counties have between themselves because it does affect funding levels, because as your mileage would happen to grow through that, your funding levels would change. And the counties are very good at monitoring each other's. Through the 90s, there was hardly any change in the size of the system. More recently, there has been a lot more leniency in the acknowledgement that some growing areas did not have an adequate representation of state aid systems, and now in the last 4 or 5 years, there's been no growth again as counties have been dealing with preservation issues. But it's a matter between the counties and the way the cards were originally set out in the 1950s.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Perry.
With a county state aid highway, then, for an example, if you designate one, you rebuild it to the tune of $2 million, does that end then the state aid on that county state aid highway, or is this an ongoing process of you will always get X amount of money for that county state aid highway?
Mr. Danielson?
What happens under the current system, and part of the way that you generate money for your particular county and your particular road is through construction needs. So currently when we in Canyon County rebuild a section of road, whether it's 1 mile or 10 miles or 13 or whatever it happens to be, the construction needs that have been on the books they come off. So we've done a lot of reconstruction in our county, and those portions of roads that we have reconstructed no longer are getting a need factor or drawing money for a complete rebuild. They do continue to draw money for additional resurfacing because it's recognized that over a period of time that you need to be putting money away in order to do resurfacing on that particular road. Whether in our case we don't use that state aid money, we use other dollars, but many, many counties do use those state aid dollars because they don't have the wherewithal to use other funds. I would say that another issue we end up having is perhaps you spent a lot of state aid money on a highway, and maybe you do a new system plan, and 10 years down the road, you decide this would make a better road than this one, but you spent money on it. There's a mechanism within the rules that if you make a decision like that, you end up having to pay back to the state aid account a prorated portion of the dollars on this road you did rebuild. So you simply can't change your system. There is, a 20-year window on that. So we have changed a lot of roads over the years because, you know, the rural landscape has changed. But it's always been a system trade within the county. We've never requested additional mileage in our particular case.
Thank you. Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. How does that turn back process work? You talked about turning back some roads from the county to the township. Is there a set process that you need to go through?
Mr. Danielson.
There is a process in the law that allows the counties to do that, but it's prescribed in there that if you are going to do that, you do have to go through a public hearing where the county board actually has to go out to the township in question, hold their hearing there, get all the input, and then make a decision. There's a condition on whether you can turn it back or not. The condition on whether you can turn it back or not is this road in good enough shape? Does it have the adequate cross sections and strength and gravel surfacing that would make it a typical road for that particular township? Mm-hmm. So if it's not, you have to bring it up to what you would be called a township standards. And if you'd in that front page, there's a few of those roads that are identified on the map. We know there's some roads that have never been touched and are basically a path in the prairie out there. Mm-hmm. That we do have to spend some money on before we would expect a township to assume the liability on that.
Okay.
A couple other things happened. One is if the county does turn back a road, we're required by law to continue to maintain that for a two-year period so the township is able to adjust its budget to take that road on. One of the things that has made it a little easier to go through the turnback process is with our townships. Really two things. One, they understand where we're coming from, that you know a local access road maybe should be theirs, whether it's a city street or a township road. But the other thing is that maybe 20 years ago, part of the state aid dollars that come in are distributed back into the town road account. Mm-hmm. So in our county, and I think it's probably true across the state, it's probably around $400 a mile, that state aid that comes in to help those township maintain the road.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you, as you look at your system and try to determine, you know, what can we maintain given the resources we have you turned any asphalt roads back to gravel?
We did at one time, and there was enough of a organized desire by the people affected by that it ended up being brought back. I guess from the standpoint of our county, which in general is growing, mm-hmm. and in general is growing in its need to handle heavy commercial traffic, there are a couple roads that certainly are going to be discussed in the future because of population loss and to a certain extent ag loss in the more rugged part of our county, mm-hmm. that it wouldn't be surprise me that at some point when the next resurfacing is required, we will take a hard look at taking that surface off, recycling it, and going back to a gravel-type surface. But it's not a large part of our planning process because of the growth factor and the truck factor.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Mr. Chair, just one of those things I think we have to be willing to have on the table. Mm-hmm. You know, no one wants to have a gravel road. I think everybody would like their road to be paved, but that doesn't mean we have either the population or the funds to do that with every mile of road in the state. So,
Senator, what a lot of it is dependent on your ability to keep a road in shape so people have something decent to drive on. And it may be at 200 cars a day, it may be at 225 or 250 or 175, depending on how many trucks are on there. But there's a point where gravel is very difficult to maintain. We do maintain a number of them that have 250 ADT on it that are not paved, but we use base stabilizers and we use a lot of chloride in order to make that work. Mm.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for coming, Mr. Danielson. Appreciate it. Mr. Jonas, if you'd introduce your next
Mr. testifier. Chair, Mark Krebsbach from Dakota County.
We still have the Office of Aeronautics to testify yet, so we'll move right through your presentation, Mr. Krebsbach. Appreciate you being here. Are you on your way to the conference also?
Mr. Chair, I am. Thank you. I appreciate being here, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Mark Krebsbach. I'm the Transportation Director and County Engineer for Dakota County. And Mr. Danielson and I did prepare presentations that are similar in format, so I'll try to focus a little bit on the differences in our two counties and not go through a lot of the background detail and
appreciate
keep you on schedule for your next portion of the presentation. Dakota County is located just southeast of the Twin Cities area. We are a rapidly growing county up until the most recent economic downturn. We've been hovering right around 400,000 people in population. But yet with that, as you look at the county in terms of land area, about two-thirds of the county is still rural in nature, and we're actually, I still believe, in the top 30 in agricultural producing counties in the state. So we have a large rural and agricultural contingency along with the 400,000 people in the more suburban part of the county. We're connected to the Twin Cities largely by river crossings. We're separated by rivers and rely on the Hastings, Lafayette, I-35W, Cedar Avenue, 35E river crossings provide most of our connectivity to the region. Again, on this map, the county's state aid highways are shown in blue. They really form a predominantly a grid within the county connecting the trunk highways to our county roads and local streets as well. One thing that's a couple things worth noting, we really don't have an east-west continuous trunk highway south of I-494. That's a distance of 27 miles from 494 to the south border of the county. And in an east-west or north-south connecting highways, we don't have a north-south trunk highway between I-35W and Trunk Highway 3, which runs up the center of the county. So in some of our most populous areas of the county, we have about an 8-mile north-south gap between highways. So the county highway system really provides not only that local connectivity, but also a fairly large regional connectivity in Dakota County. Comparing our systems a little bit, Dakota County's county highway system is 425 miles. As you can see, about a quarter of those miles are on the county state aid highway system. About a quarter of those are county roads. We have 1,080 lane miles, which means a little bit differently from Mr. Danielson's system in Kandiyohi County. We have about 200 miles of multi-lane county state aid highway. There are about 200 segments, both the four-lane and six-lane divided highways. So some very large cross-sections on our system. We have 83 bridges, and that number is correct. We do operate 133 traffic signals on the county's system in Dakota County. As I talked about the diversity of the county with our populated areas to the north and to the west and the rural areas, you can see we also have a very diverse system in terms of the type of traffic that it carries. We carry over 46,000 cars a day on Cedar Avenue, which is our county state aid highway 23, and Apple Valley, right where it turns into Trunk Highway 77. And we have similar traffic volumes on county state aid highway 42 in Burnsville, near the Burnsville Center. Both of those highways are principal arterials and carry a very high volume of not only regular traffic, but truck traffic as well. You can contrast that to County Road 53 in the very southern part of the county, in Waterford and Scioto Townships, with 55 cars a day, which is a gravel road as well. So we have really quite a range of the type of traffic that we carry on our system. Both Mr. Jonas and Mr. Danielson mentioned the distribution of the CASA funds as they come to a county. This is a copy of our actual county state aid highway apportionment as it came to Dakota County in 2010. As you can see there, we have both the we have the county regular construction and county regular maintenance, which is the primary component of that allocation. That's the money that comes directly to the counties that we can use on any portion of our system for those specific purposes, and is split between 60% construction and 40% maintenance, as they indicated. We also have the municipal construction and maintenance accounts that Mr. Danielson mentioned, and also the town bridge and town road accounts. And I'll just mention here that the town bridges, counties do help townships administer and engineer their bridge projects. We provide support for those purposes. In our case, we did borrow ahead 3 years in our town bridge account allocation to complete the last two township bridges we had to do on our township system. Were rebuilt in 2010. So we won't see any new additional town bridge money coming for the next 3 years because we've borrowed ahead to use that. On the town road account, we receive those dollars. Each township receives funds based 50% on their township mileage and 50% on population, and then they can in turn use those dollars to make improvements on their township systems. This is a snapshot of the Dakota County five-year CIP for the upcoming 5 years, 2011 to 2015. And if you look, I'll run through this real quickly. If you look at the top with the federal and state funds, The lion's share of our federal funds are administered, as Mr. Jonas said, through the Metropolitan Council. They are the Twin Cities Area MPO, or the Metropolitan Planning Organization. They do a competitive process to prioritize and select projects every 2 years. It's a rather tedious and time-consuming process. I think our applications average about 60 pages per project, so a lot of work going to that. It's extremely competitive. Only about a third of the projects get selected for federal funding. And as you can see there, over the next 5 years, we're looking at about $37 million of federal funds. I would like to have one caveat that we do have an interchange project in our year 2015, the interchange of Trunk Highway 52 and County 42 that is not fully funded. So we're hopeful that we'll see about $15 million of federal funds on the project and is included in that total. Those funds aren't actually available at this time. The remainder, the $22.5 million that would make up the balance, are actual funds that we have programmed and are available. The state funds that show up there are state trunk highway dollars. In our case, with these projects, those are projects where our county highways intersect with trunk highways. And that dollar amount is comprised really just of three projects. It is the 52 and 42 interchange that I just mentioned. Again, that is unfunded at this time. We're hoping for about $11 million of state funds for that project. The other two projects we have are an interchange at Trunk Highway 13 and County State Aid 5 in Burnsville. That's a $22.4 million project, of which we have received about $11 million of state funds. And that project is fully funded. We're working with MnDOT, who's actually doing the design for us, and we hope to have that project under contract in 2012. So a sizable project with a large state, and in that case, a large federal contribution as well, about $7 million. The county sources that we look at are the county state aid highway, the county levy. Similar to Mr. Danielson's funding sources, there is really nothing different there. You can see that there is a portion of county levy funds in our county state aid highway going towards our county state aid highway system. One element of funding that we have in the metro area that's different than outstate is the wheelage tax. And it's based on 1972 legislation that enables counties to enact a $5 per vehicle wheelage tax. We did that in Dakota County about 5 years ago. I believe we're one of five metro counties who have levied that wheelage tax. And for our board, it was a way to try and reduce the amount of county levy funds that were going to pay for transportation and try and replace that with more of a user fee based on the automobiles that were registered in the county. You can see that that produces about $8 million a year, so a fairly sizable funding source for Dakota County. Again, the gravel tax. And in Dakota County, we have a fairly sizable contribution from the 12 cities that we have in our county to our county state aid highway projects. Each city over 5,000 does participate in our projects. We work very closely with them every year to select projects through, again, a somewhat competitive process, looking at both our county highway system needs and priorities within the city, and then make those recommendations based on our consultation with the cities to the county board to actually select which projects get funded. But because the cities do have a rather large contribution to our revenue stream, they also have a rather large say in how we go about programming projects on an annual basis. And then finally, this is where our revenue sources are going to. We've broken ours up into five different categories. We do pretty much all of our preservation work through our capital improvement program. These mostly are eligible expenses for the use of the county state aid highway maintenance funds. But our maintenance funds to date, at least, have all been used for things such as snow and ice activities, traffic signal maintenance, striping, signing, really things we do through our operations budget. These larger needs to resurface and crack seal and do gravel road resurfacing are beyond our means to handle through our maintenance allocation, so they wind up in our CIP and are funded through a combination of both county state aid highway and county levy funds. Management and safety is an area that we focus a lot of our resources. Those are for things like traffic signals, intersection improvements with new turn lanes, access management, where you try and consolidate access onto our county highways. That's really the area where we try and maximize our existing highway investment to get as much capacity and as much safety as we possibly can before we have to take the step to add new capacity to the roadways through lane additions, interchanges, major improvements that would require a much greater investment. The next two categories are a couple that are really challenges facing our county. The replacement category is when we actually have to go in and replace elements of our system because they've worn out, they're old, they're no longer structurally capable. On the bridge side, like Mr. Danielson and Candiohi County, our bridges are in good shape. We currently have no bridges that are structurally deficient. Again, we thank you for the support of the bridge bonding program. It's allowed us to stay on top of our bridge investment. We just recently had two bridges that were determined to be functionally obsolete. And what that means is the traffic volumes on those roads has grown to the point where the cross-section of the bridge is no longer sufficient based on standards to carry the traffic. They're in good structural shape, but they're narrower than they should be. So those are bridges we'll be looking at over the next several years. But on the highway side of things, as we look at our system, right now about a quarter of our system is 60 years old or older since it was last reconstructed. By 2030, 20 years from now, more than half of our system, based on current funding, will be more than 60 years old. Roads last a long time, but they don't last forever. And with the funding stream we see coming in, a lot of our system is going to be nearing the end of its useful life. Even as we try to maximize the management part of it, you know, get as much life out of the capacity and safety as we can, and more importantly, as we try and preserve the system the best we can through resurfacing, crack sealing, and all those preventative operations that we take. So age is a big factor in our system in the coming years. And then finally, on the expansion side, that's where we deal with growth in our system. These are really expensive projects. Typical interchange for us runs between $25 and $40 million. They're typically done in conjunction with MnDOT and with cities, so a lot of funding sources have to come together to make those projects happen. For a mile of four-lane divided highway, our costs are typically in the range of $5 to $8 million a mile. We recently undertook a six-lane reconstruction with Scott County on County Road 42 in the very western part of our county in Burnsville and about a half mile into Scott County. That was a two-mile project that ran us close to $30 million by the time we accounted for right-of-way, front-edge roads, and a six-lane upgrade. Extremely expensive. And because of that, we get to program very few of those projects. It's hard to find the dollars to make those happen. The result for us is that by 2030, as we look out at our system, about a quarter of the miles on our system will be at or near capacity. So growth is going to be a major factor as we look to the future. With that, you can see kind of how the CASA and county funding sources split. Certainly more county road funds in the preservation and management areas than there are in replacement or expansion. And a pretty big share of our funds for the county state aid highway system reside in those management and replacement areas. Just not a lot of dollars available right now to get to those preservation needs. So with that, I'll try to cover a few differences in our system, and I'd be more than happy to try and answer any questions you may have, Mr. Chair, or members of the committee.
Thank you for the presentation. Mr. Danielson must have answered all of the questions for you. Got you off the hook. But
figured he had the tough challenge with those first questions.
Appreciate you coming in, and you have a good conference.
Thank you.
Mr. Kreisbach.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the chance to do this overview today. It was difficult to put an overview together and cover such a wide area, but those are good questions that we got asked. I think we were successful in opening up a dialogue as far as what state aid is, and be glad to come back at any time to answer other questions.
Appreciate that.
I turn it back to Tim Hinkle.
Mr. Hinkle.
Mr. Chairman, members, I will quickly move to the next item on your agenda, which is an overview of the Modal Planning and Program Management Division within the department. to get started on that overview and to move to aeronautics, I want to just quickly reiterate a couple of points that the commissioner made in his overview remarks at the last meeting. First and foremost, MnDOT's charge. Note that MnDOT's charge is not solely highways. MnDOT's charge goes well beyond to what's stated here, including aeronautics, highways, motor carriers, ports, public transit, railroads, pipelines, and does include facilities for walking and pedestrian. You do have an organizational chart. The last time you couldn't read it on the screen. You can make note of that. In particular, as you look at the organization and how it's laid out to provide for that charge, we have this modal planning and program management division, which cuts across all of the modes and is responsible for coordinating and leading statewide investment activities, as well as planning, programming, and policy development for the department. As you look through that list, you can see that there are a number of offices. You will have a chance to hear from a couple more of those offices over the course of the next couple of meetings. Your next slide provides you a list of contacts. Should you need to reach anybody in any of those offices, this list is a handy-dandy list for you to look at if you need to contact me or any of those office directors in each of those offices responsible for those functions. And finally, let me just quickly move into aeronautics so that we can cover that today, which is the first division presentation, and introduce Chris Roy, the director of that office. Let me just capture very quickly what the general role and responsibility of that office is by law. When you look at the statutes and look at the responsibilities, you will see that this aeronautics office has a number of responsibilities, many of which many are not familiar with. Primary function, of course, is administering state and federal funds for the municipal airports across the state. That said, this office is also responsible for another set of activities, including regulation, inspection, and licensing of aviation operations, registering aircraft, assisting communities with their planning activities for aviation and air service issues. This office also provides radio and visual navigation aids, as well as electrical and lighting systems for those airports across the state. And it also collects and disseminates weather information for pilots, provides aviation safety and aviation education materials and programs, as well as furnishing air transportation services for state employees as well as the governor. So with that as a very quick introduction to this division, I'll hand it over to the director, Chris Roy, to give you a little more detail on that office.
Welcome to the committee, and if you'd state your name for the record, I appreciate it.
Sure. My name is Chris Roy. I'm the office director of the Office of Aeronautics with MnDOT. Good afternoon. Very much appreciate the opportunity to come here and give a little overview on the Office of Aeronautics. Kind of the agenda for the program here, talk a little bit about our system and the impacts that airports have on the state's economy, get into MnDOT's role, and then talk a little bit about the revenues and how our office is funded, as well as the projects that we do, and then the expenditures out of the office itself. So the state aviation system consists of 136 airports. 97 of those 136 are eligible to receive federal funds, so they're a part of the national system. Of those 136 airports, we have 8 that are currently served by commercial or scheduled air service. Those 8 are Rochester, Minneapolis-St. Paul, Duluth, Brainerd, International Falls, Hibbing, and Thief River Falls. In addition to the number of airports, we've got just under 12,000 licensed pilots across the state of Minnesota, 7,100 registered aircraft. We do about 31 million commercial passengers in and out of the state each and every year. And then in addition to all of that, we also have about 150 state-owned navigational aids at different various airports throughout the system. Why that number, 150, is greater than the number of airports, many airports have more than one navigational aid in order to get it in there. It could be an automated weather system in conjunction with instrument landing approach system, which would be the mechanism for the airplane to be guided on into that landing and final approach back down onto the runway. This is just a map of the state that kind of shows you where the different airports are. The ones noted by the red airplane are the ones that have commercial air service. The rest of them there with the square dot are paved in runways, And then we do have also some turf runways. And many of the airports that have the paved primary runway also have a turf crosswind runway, which would be a backup runway for lighter aircraft in order to them get in and out under certain wind conditions. Airports have a great impact to the state of Minnesota. Recently, we had the University of Minnesota conduct a study to try and help us define what that impact is. What they found was a total of $12.3 billion of economic impact each and every year is generated by the airports and the presence of airports to the state of Minnesota. On top of that, there's about 164,000 jobs being created through the aviation industry in the state of Minnesota, and that's everything from pilots that work on the commercial air service side, or we also have an industry up in Duluth. Cirrus manufactures light aircraft. They employ around 1,000 people. There's a lot of activity that's happening at airports, a lot of people there, and then there's a lot of the secondary jobs. So in total, there's about 164,000 jobs being generated through the aviation industry in the state of Minnesota. Aviation as a whole is a lot broader than what many people think. Many people just believe that it's the scheduled air service, it's Delta or Sun Country, whoever it might be. But really, that only accounts for about 25% of the overall operations of flights throughout the state of Minnesota, but also the nation. The rest of those flights, the 75% remaining or so, is really general aviation. And general aviation can be everything from a very small plane, maybe a 2 or 4 seater, all the way up to a very nice business class jet that maybe 3M or some of our other larger businesses might have. So aviation as a whole serves a lot of different needs. It goes everything from business aviation, agriculture aviation on the western part of our state, southern part of the state. There's a lot of agriculture going out there, and a lot of crop spraying, crop surveys is all done through the air using different types of aircraft. The medical, whether it be helicopters, doing air ambulance things, but there's also a lot of fixed wing or airplane air ambulance being used from airport to airport in transfers. It's also a way of getting organ donations very quickly. It's very time sensitive, so there's a lot of those going on in the middle of the night flying across the state, but also the nation. And then lastly, we've got a lot of cargo in the state. Most of it comes through MSP, but not all of it. When you order a package and you live in rural Minnesota, you order it over the internet, you want it there the next day, that package then is probably sent to MSP in the middle of the night, and then it's transferred to a smaller airplane and then brought to the Bemidji's or wherever else scattered throughout the state, and then finally to that delivery truck so it's at your door at 10 o'clock in the morning. MnDOT's role and how we get involved in aviation in the state is we're one of the agencies, we are the agency that oversees the airports, and we ensure that the safety of the system is as it should be. And we do that by issuing airport licenses, and as we do those public airport license, we go out and we survey the airport to make sure that there's no obstructions in the final approaches to the runways. We make sure that all the lighting and everything is up to standards in order to make it a safe and functioning airport. We do the same thing for zoning. State of Minnesota, the rules and statutes require that airports be zoned. The municipality itself creates a joint zoning board that adopts the zoning for that airport and submits it to the Department of Transportation for its approval. We go through the process of reviewing that zoning and making sure that it's up to standards, or if there are deviations, that those deviations make reasonable and still provide for a safe airport. Lastly, the last part of safety that we get involved in is a number of pilot safety seminars. We go out on a fairly regular basis out to communities, and we inform pilots, make sure that they're it's kind of similar to the defensive driving program that you might have on the cars. We go out and we kind of bring forward some issues that maybe pilots are either not familiar with, or maybe it's just good to hear again. So we try to do that in order to maintain that safe system. One of the larger areas that we have is airport development, and airport development actually is where all the construction grants, not only the state grants, but also the federal grants, are administered through. And the types of projects we do with those grants and dollars would be everything from preservation projects, maintaining the condition of the runways, resurfacing the runways, the navigational aids that might be needed at different airports, buildings, airport equipment, but we also get into planning and engineering that needs to be done at airports in order to develop long-range and airport layout plans for different airports. A couple of other sections that we do have inside of our office is we've got a planning section that currently we're just starting the process of developing a 20-year plan. So it'd be our long-range plan for aviation in the state. In conjunction with that, we'll also have an investment plan. So we'll take a look at anticipated revenues, and we'll weigh that against the needs that would be in this long-range plan. And we'll try to put together a plan that really addresses what we think will need to happen in the aviation community for the next 20 years. We do something a little unique to MnDOT, and that aircraft registration is actually handled in our office. So our office will mail out roughly 5,000 active licenses to different aircraft owners, and we collect those revenues, and that goes directly into the airport's fund. And then in addition to that, Tim had mentioned, we also do air transportation of state employees. We do that through a couple of use of our airplanes, and it's just a more efficient way of getting people around the state in order to conduct their business. A couple of initiatives that we've undertaken and are going on right now, that statewide system plan, that's our 20-year plan. That's just starting, and in the course of the next year, we'll be working on that and developing that plan to make sure that we've got a system and we're spending our dollars wisely so that system would be able to continue to be used for the next 20 years in a very safe and efficient manner. The next bullet point is wide area multilateration, and what that is kind of a fancy term for filling a radar gap. Currently, we've got a part of our state around Alexandria up to Bemidji that is not seen by air traffic control. The radar coverage there, particularly closer to the ground, is not adequate. If you're in a jet airliner at 8 to 10,000 feet and above, you are seen, but smaller aircraft that are coming in and out of these airports are not seen. So we've worked with the federal government and come up with a next-gen technology that's called wide area multilateration. Simply takes the signal off of a transponder of an airplane, triangulates that position through some ground stations, and it sends that information back to air traffic control, and air traffic controller then sees that aircraft in some instances all the way down to the ground, or in other instances maybe about 1,000 to 2,000 feet up. So it's a big improvement. It's something we're working on right now in the planning phases and hope to have it implemented here in the coming years or so. One of the other larger efforts is MAC zoning efforts. MAC operates several different airports across the metropolitan area. We're in the process of zoning or rezoning all of those airports. Right now in front of us we have St. Paul Airport, and Flying Cloud will be coming here shortly as well. MSP has been zoned a couple of years ago. And then the last one is maintaining and enhancing scheduled air service. Over the last many years, we've lost many communities had scheduled air service. We're now down to 8. About a year ago, we lost St. Cloud. And it's kind of a trend that's occurring in the airline industry, and it's one that we'd like to try to reverse, or at least be able to hold on to the cities that we do currently have. Having that scheduled air service is a way of those businesses and those communities staying as viable as possible, and having a way of getting business to conduct business in an efficient manner by using those scheduled airline carriers to get out to the rest of the nation as well as the world. And how we're doing that to maintain and enhance that is we do have a very small grant program that the communities that do have airports with scheduled service, we do some marketing strategies with them in order to try and maintain that service and improve that service. Revenues. State Airport Fund comes from three primary sources. We've got airline flight property tax, a little bit of interest, aviation fuel tax, and then aircraft registration tax is how the airport fund is compiled. You can see the different amounts there. Air flight property tax is a tax that's paid by airlines in lieu of other taxes, and those other taxes are really aircraft registration taxes. There's a little bit of other flight equipment that factors into that. The Commissioner of Transportation determines what the rate of that levy is in order to sufficiently fund the state airport fund. We certify that amount. We send it to the Department of Revenue by the end of each and every year, and then the airlines pay that tax in March. Aviation fuel tax is on a percent basis, or per gallon basis, I should say. It ranges from 5 cents all the way down to a half a cent, and it depends on how much aviation fuel you use throughout the year. So if you're a small user, you're probably paying 5 cents per gallon. If you're a larger user, like one of the airliners, you could very well be in that half a cent per gallon tax range for most of the year. Aircraft registration is calculated, and there's a formula in statute as to how it's calculated, but what we do is we take the Blue Book value of the aircraft for the very first year, and we take 1% of it, that Blue Book value, and that is what the registration is for that current year. Then the second year, we take 90% of that first year, and then finally for the, well, we do that at a reduced rate all the way down to the seventh year, when it would be 25% of that 1% of the original value, Blue Book value of that aircraft, or $50, whichever is greater, because there are some instances where that tax would actually be less than that. So it's a way of kind of prorating in the amount. So the newer the aircraft, the more you're going to pay, the more expensive the original value of the aircraft, the more you're going to pay as well.
Could I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
I don't know if Delta has any new jets or not, but if a new Delta jet serviced Minnesota, would they register under this program? Would that aircraft be registered?
Delta and most of the, actually all of the other scheduled airlines will actually fall under this air flight property tax instead.
Okay.
So they would pay their amount through this means as opposed to actually registering different aircraft.
Okay.
Senator Little?
Mr. Chair, my understanding on the aircraft registration tax is that we have one of the highest, if not the highest tax, registration tax in the country. Could you please compare this registration fee or tax to, say, Wisconsin or to other states? And my understanding also is that it does not affect Delta. It does affect our companies that hire, that create jobs in the state of Minnesota, and their decision about where to place their planes or where to purchase their planes or where to register them. Could you please talk with us a little bit about that?
Chair, Senator. Our registration tax is higher than some of the surrounding states and some others in the nation. Generally speaking, though, the registration tax or the amount that goes towards airports is paid for in one mean or another. So in states where the registration tax may be lower, many of them actually have a higher fuel tax rate. Or maybe there's some additional levies that are placed, maybe general fund dollars are coming in. And really, in one way, shape, or another, the cost to operate an airport is remains the same. We've got a pretty good system. We've got a lot of navigational aids. We've got a very safe system. In order to maintain that, it's going to cost a certain amount of money in order to just put back into the airport. Registration is one of the means that we do it. You're right about the Delta question where the airliners do go into the flight line property tax, but if you look at that pie chart here, the airline flight property tax is $7.8 million. Delta pays roughly half that. Aircraft registration is at about $6 million. The other point that I wanted to make about aircraft registration and businesses registering their aircraft, may possibly in other states, is that if they are, as per state statutes, if they are a Minnesota-owned business, if they enter Minnesota airspace even one day, they are responsible for paying Minnesota registration of their aircraft. If they are a non-Minnesota business, then if they enter the state more than 60 days, they are required to pay that registration.
Mr. Chair, follow up,
Senator Lilly.
Again, my understanding of this tax is that in Wisconsin, a corporate jet, would pay about a corporation located in Wisconsin with their home headquarters or in the Dakotas or in Iowa would pay about $10,000 for a corporate jet. In Minnesota, that same charge would be about $200,000. Would that range be about right? That is something I've heard from one of our corporate leaders in the state. And if that is the case,
this probably plays a significant role in corporate decisions about where to locate their plants, where to locate their headquarters, and I'm concerned about the message that this is sending to companies that are trying to hire employees in the state of Minnesota, Mr. Chair. Yep.
Chair and Senator.
Mr. Roy.
The exact specifics of other states, I don't have that information in front of me, and I'd be more than happy to provide that with you about what a typical airplane might pay here. But it's not out of the question to have that very same scenario if it's a new aircraft or a newer aircraft in that around $200,000 range, where in other states it could be significantly less than that.
Thank you.
Senator?
Would you review again for me on the aviation fuel tax,
yes.
Tax paid on fuel purchased, did you say that it decreased with volume?
Senator, that's exactly what does happen. If you're a small user, you know, if I owned a small aircraft and just used it a little bit, I would be paying 5 cents per gallon, and that would be true for the first 50,000 gallons of use. So even Delta, a very large user of fuel, would be taxed on that first 50,000 gallons at 5 cents. And then at 50,001 gallons, they'd be at 2 cents for that first gallon, and then that'd go up into those graduated ranges that we have. So at some point, most of the airliners, many of the airliners, are going to be in either the 1 cent per gallon range or possibly the half a cent per gallon range.
Senator Gimsey, just one follow-up question,
sure.
Because I was interested in this discussion about the registration tax. Is it possible for us to see a full comparison, not just looking at one way in which we're funding this, but what a corporation might experience across all of these funding streams and then comparative for other surrounding states so that we're not getting a skewed perspective about what the costs are? I know a lot of times our businesses will point to one thing that's really higher than another, but we don't take a look at it collectively. It'd be important for me at least to understand that collectively.
Right. Given a little bit of time, I think we can certainly do that. It's going to be a little challenging to get all of the aspects because a lot of times there's little nuances income tax that we may not be aware of, but I think we can give you a broader sense. Some of the other surrounding states have a much higher fuel tax rate than what we have. I believe it's one of the Dakotas is 8 cents per gallon all the time. So there are definitely some variances, and we can certainly provide that information if you'd so like.
Thank you, Mr. Roy.
Okay. I think moving on, that was kind of the revenue side. And now that we've collected that money, where does the state fund, airport fund, where do we expend it? And this is just a pie chart kind of showing you the broad categories as to where the dollars are spent. As you can see, about half of the dollars are in construction, another 20% or so in maintenance. Those construction grants would be anything from resurfacing and constructing a new runway. And it also would include some possibly building, remodeling of airport buildings that they might have, or in addition to all of that, it could also be some equipment that would be needed specifically for the airport, whether it be snowplows or potentially lawnmowers and other things like that. All of those items are needed in order to provide a safe and operating, fully functional airport. The state airports fund totals about $18-19 million on an annual basis, and about half of that goes towards construction. In addition to the state airports fund, our office channels a lot of federal dollars. In total, it's $83.5 million of federal money was channeled through our office. That comes from the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. And generally speaking, most of those dollars are on a 95-5 split. So 95% federal dollars, 5% local, so there's 5% match on most federal money. And you can see that the breakdown of that $83 million, about $12.5 million go to primary entitlements, and that's defined by federal law. And the airports that receive those are primarily scheduled airports that have scheduled air service. Non-primary entitlements would be to those airports that are in the federal system but do not have scheduled air service. State apportionment and discretion are two accounts that are used, and that's the FAA and or MnDOT involving a lot of decisions and deciphering, prioritizing the projects and where those dollars go based on priorities. And then last year we also had the economic stimulus dollars or the ARRA dollars that's included in that $83.5 million. So in total, we had just right around $100 million of construction projects in last fiscal year. When you combine those state and federal dollars, this kind of a pie chart here shows where those projects are actually shown. So this is only the construction side. You can see that about 45% went to airport pavements and lighting, actual improvements to airports and the air side of the airport. We've got the next biggest category was 32% went to buildings. Most of that was actually three large terminal projects, Duluth, Bemidji, and Brainerd, all underway. So that was a little unusual year that we had that much going towards buildings. About 7% for equipment, 11% for engineering, land, and zoning grants, and then a little bit on some fuel systems and upgrades, and then safety and security, rounding out the percentages there.
Very good. Thank you for your presentation. We're watching the clock closely here. We have another committee going to be coming in here at 3 o'clock. And for their benefit, we want to adjourn in a timely fashion. But appreciate your presentation. Committee members, if you have any additional questions or need any other information, you can certainly contact staff or the Department of Aeronautics directly. We appreciate you coming in. And Mr. Henkel, Mr. Roy, thank you.
Thank you.
Our next meeting will be January the 20th with this coming Thursday, and we will have MnDOT, Office Freight and Rail, and Ports, and then the MAC will be here, the Metropolitan Airports Commission. So until then, the committee is adjourned.